From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The man passed over 2 years ago for the executive editorship of the New York Times was named on Monday to just that prestigious post. Times columnist and former managing editor Bill Keller will replace Joe Lelyveld, the former executive editor who came out of retirement to run the paper last month after Howell Raines resigned. Raines, of course, was sent packing in the wake of the Jason Blair scandal, but in the end, he did not go quietly. 3 nights before Keller's appointment, Raines went on the Charlie Rose Show to give his version of the story and to discuss his relationship with Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger.
Arthur sent me to the newsroom to be a change agent, to lead a talented staff that was settled into a kind of lethargic culture of complacency, into being a performance culture.
I'm joined now by Times executive editor-to-be Bill Keller. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, there was a good deal of revisionism in the Raines interview on Charlie Rose. Mickey Kaus notes in Slate.com, and I quote, "Guess all that contrition Raines displayed when he was campaigning to save his job was bogus. He wouldn't admit to a single mistake except having excessively high standards and moving too fast. His argument is he was done in by lazy, Lelyveldian pygmies who were defending the status quo against his bold vision of change." So, you're seen as a man in the Lelyveld tradition. Is he talking about you?
If he is, I don't mind so much. But what bothered me listening to that interview was the at least implicit and gratuitous insult to a lot of reporters. I mean, I was there and watched them cover a couple of Balkan wars and a presidential scandal, an impeachment, an election, a contentious recount, and a lot of other big stories, and if that was lethargy, you could have fooled me.
So then what do you think is the biggest problem at the paper? Or to put it differently, what's the biggest challenge that you face?
Well, the immediate task, I think, is just really to finish what Joe Lelyveld has started. That's getting people refocused on their work and a little less focused on our own, you know, internal angst. There'll be a kind of intermediate stage of trying to institute some systemic reforms, safeguards for our credibility, some recommendations on how we recruit and train, and some things having to do with the culture in the newsroom.
Let's see if we can unpack some of that. First of all, the issue of credibility and accuracy. I'm going to be frank and say that I certainly don't think the Times has an accuracy problem compared to other papers. It's just read more closely by more people. Mm-hmm. But having offered that sincerely felt suck-up, what about the enormous correction the Times printed this week to a story about a recording industry executive? It concluded basically that the reporter didn't know what she was talking about.
That's right. And I'm in the happy position of not being in the newsroom yet, and therefore I'm able to plead ignorance. But clearly that reflects a problem. And there are sort of two parts of it. There's the how on earth did this happen? And I don't know whether that's, you know, a systemic problem or a personnel problem or some of both. But then there's the second question of what do you do when you screw up? And that part of it, I think we can be proud of. You know, we screwed up big and we owned up big.
I remember that a couple of years ago you penned, I won't call it a mea culpa for the foreign desk, but let's call it an explanation of how reporters under you may have rushed to judgment on Wen Ho Lee, who was wrongly accused of spying.
You can call it a mea culpa if you want. I think it kind of was. You know, there are still people out there who will point to the Wen Ho Lee case, you know, as a black mark in our record book. And maybe to an extent it was, but I think the way we handled it and came clean about our own shortcomings was, in the end, probably a healthy thing for our credibility.
I guess I didn't call it a mea culpa because a lot of people who read the follow-ups at the time felt that there wasn't a clear enough admission that there had been a rush to judgment.
Well, we didn't apologize for things that we didn't think were wrong. There was a notion that some people put out that we had, you know, conducted a racist witch hunt aimed at persecuting this innocent man, and I don't think that's true. So we didn't admit that then, and I don't think you'd find anybody around here inclined to admit it now.
You told the Wall Street Journal that you imagined that the paper would be more decentralized than it was under Raines. Does that mean essentially returning power back to the section editors?
It means returning a lot of the power back to the section editors. You know, look, I don't believe in anarchy, and we're not a democracy. You know, we don't sort of take a plebiscite on how to cover a story or how to make up the front page and things like that. But this is essentially a bottom-up business. You know, information happens down where reporters are, and the best ideas tend to happen there too. And you have to create a kind of system where those ideas percolate up.
But bottom-up news management seemed to have been something of a Joe Lelyveld innovation. If you go back to the Charlie Rose show, Rain said that humility and modesty weren't adjectives that leapt to mind when reviewing the pantheon of Times chiefs. You are going to order people around, aren't you, Bill?
Sure I am. Sure I am. I'm not going to surrender my license to go talk to a reporter, meddle in a story, occasionally ask whether the lead on a story might be better a different way. Every once in a while you do that, but every time you do it, you're sort of chipping away a little bit at the initiative and enterprise of the reporter.
Could you talk about the competitive environment for a news organization now? Do you think this environment demands the kind of flood-the-zone intensity that Howell Raines was so proud of?
Sadly, I think it's probably less competitive than it was in general because the number of competitive media outlets has declined. The number of reporters committed to important things like foreign coverage has declined. And I think that's not a healthy thing for a democracy. My general philosophy about news coverage is, you know, there are stories where you take everybody you've got and throw them at the story. And, you know, clearly September 11th was one of those stories. The war in Iraq was one of those stories. But most of what we do most of the time does not lend itself to blitzkrieg coverage, you know, how the government spends its money and people falling into poverty and local government deciding things that affect your lives. And in fact, some of those are not really, in the sense you're mentioning, competitive stories at all. They're stories that a newspaper like The Times will do because it has the resources to do them. But if we don't, nobody will.
Bill Keller is the newly appointed executive editor of the New York Times, and he'll be taking up the new post on July 30th. Thank you very much.
Okay.
It's been dubbed the world's largest news organization, and it has a new boss, and it's not the New York Times. The Associated Press is the not-for-profit news cooperative that provides stories, images, and sound to more than 15,000 news outlets worldwide. This summer, Tom Curley, formerly the president and publisher of USA Today, took over as the AP's new president and CEO. Curley has taken charge of the 155-year-old news organization that considers itself, quote, the backbone of the world's information system. Bob caught up with him to find out how it's going so far.
Tom, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob. Glad to be with you.
Congratulations. You've just gone from a very nice job at a corporation where you had basically one boss to a cooperative where you have like 5,000 bosses. Are you insane?
You know, ahead of time, I thought that would be a huge problem. But the commitment to the Associated Press is so strong that I'm really becalmed about that now. It's just dealing with the lions and dragons that are in the competitive set.
Well, let's talk about the competition. There was a time when United Press International was AP's direct competition, but those days are clearly over. UPI is just a shadow of its former self. But what is the competitive environment?
On text, it's Reuters. On business or certain areas, it's the Bloombergs that have come up. And then in photos or images, you have the merger of Getty Images and Agence France-Presse. So everywhere there's somebody important, well-funded, and also under pressure to raise revenues. So it's pretty serious wherever you look, but that makes it fun too.
But does AP dominate at this point in all of those areas? I mean, have you entered a situation where it's your game to lose?
I would never say that. You never look at it that way. I think AP has a leadership position. There's no question. It's the oldest service, the largest, and most complete. But there are places where we need to do better. And in some cases, we're going to have to go a little faster to catch up.
At USA Today, I understand planning for the brave new digital future was something approaching an obsession. What does the internet mean to the Associated Press?
Well, for me, it's become clear in the month that I've been here that it is everything. I see it as the perfect content play. AP can deliver great journalism, blend it with an electronic infrastructure, and put together a database, if you will, and allow our many members or subscribers to customize how they want to receive it and when they want to receive it, and hopefully in what language as well.
I begin my day reading your Wire. I mean, even before I pick up the New York Times and the Washington Post, I look at the AP over Yahoo. Does this suggest some sort of direct news delivery model for the future that would actually bypass your constituent news organizations?
Not bypass, but it is a part of the real world, and some of the ramifications, frankly, are a bit daunting. One of them is the theft of intellectual property. It has been increasingly hard for us to hold on to the AP brand and restrictions as to who gets access to what level of service. But I still see customized reports and a way of providing services to members that helps them with some of the issues they're facing. If AP could provide Agate sports pages or the financial numbers and data and move it all here, maybe that relieves some of the expense pressure on the newspaper members. And if we can provide more video that is sourced from us in a membership cooperative way, then perhaps the broadcast members can see some of their costs go away as well.
You are replacing Lou Bacardi, an AP institution who was 18 years in the job that you've just accepted. Let's just say that you stay in the job 18 years too. Will the Associated Press in any way resemble in the year 2021 the organization that you've just taken over?
I think in many key ways, absolutely. And the key ways are the values and the mission. The values of straight, fast, fair cannot change. And the mission is that we are and we remain a news service. Where that news ends up, how that news is collected, will fundamentally be revolutionized. But what we do and the values that surround that cannot change.
All right. Well, listen, all the best and congratulations once again.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Tom Curley is the president and CEO of the Associated Press.
Coming up, you are what you write. We consider the language police, a gender detector, and why online people may still know you're a dog. This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. For most of the history of American education, school textbooks have had only one or two authors. But sometime in the 70s, special interest groups got involved, representing, say, Native Americans or Southern Baptists or atheists, each claiming that their group was misrepresented or underrepresented in texts. Publishers began to examine what could be latent racism or godlessness or godliness in its textbooks, and lists of unacceptable terms like man of war, Satan, and Navajo sprouted up as guides on how to cater to the pressure groups. Today, textbooks are produced by committees of authors, editors, and consultants, all dependent on those lists. Diane Ravitch has detailed all this in her new book, The Language Police. Bob recently spoke to her about the outbreak of self-censorship.
There are about, well, I'd say in excess of 500 words that I've been able to identify that are not supposed to appear. I guess the one that I find the most objectionable is brotherhood. There are also words like extremist and cult and dogma. some publishers, not all, but some of them will not use them because they're considered ethnocentric words. There are also many topics that are removed from both textbooks and testing. The state of Michigan, for instance, has in its bias guidelines, you can't have a test question about, if you can believe this, flying saucers or aliens, because that might imply evolution. You can't have a story about a hurricane or an earthquake, because that might upset someone. You can't have a story about witchcraft or sorcery. You can't have a story that mentions pumpkins. You can't have a story that represents social inequality. I mean, it just goes on and on to the point where all you're left with are these very, very bland passages.
What do you suppose is motivating the people who are excising these terms from textbooks? Are they well-meaning, or are they just caving into special interests?
It's both. I think that in the first instance, the people who do this think that they're doing a good thing. Also, the textbook publishers have been through a lot of very unpleasant experiences where the State Board of Education, particularly in California and Texas, will say, we can't adopt your book unless you make these changes. Since they know that they will be confronted with demands for changes, they've internalized all those demands and now, as a matter of form, will excise words and topics before the State Department of Education takes a look at their book.
It's kind of ironic that at the same time as we're witnessing this ongoing official sensitization of language, on the flip side, the popular culture is getting ever more coarse. Is it possible that the very sensitivities of the official classes is actually fueling the growing vulgarization of the pop culture?
Believe it or not, a couple of years ago, Camille Paglia wrote an essay in which she made exactly that argument, that there is this kind of enforced politeness that goes on for hour after hour, and then kids get out of school and they call each other horrible names and they listen to music in which all kinds of vulgarity and is the coin of the realm. There's such a disconnect between the broader culture, which is very open and very free form, and what kids encounter in school, that I think it creates both boredom and cynicism. They realize what they read in school is totally detached from reality.
Some of these sensitivities are clearly absurd and over the top, but aren't some of these others actually perfectly reasonable reactions to legitimate sensitivities by people who have been historically stigmatized by language? I can certainly see how the blind don't want to be identified as the blind, as if their whole existence flows out of their visual disability. I can see how they would want to be known as people who are blind.
That's possible. I think as far as the stigma issue goes, I can understand people saying, I would like to be referred to otherwise. I just think that I don't like the banning of words that are perfectly legitimate. And I think even ethnic slurs have their place in literature. It would be hard to read a lot of our late 20th century literature and remove every word that was offensive to anybody. You'd be left with something that looked very much like a textbook.
Well, Diane, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Diane Ravitch is a professor of education at New York University and author of The Language Police.
Even the most neutral words can carry subtle messages. A team of researchers has developed an algorithm that can predict a writer's sex about 80% of the time based solely on how often they use several simple words like you, the, some, and with. Recently, Clive Thompson wrote an article in the Boston Globe about this so-called gender detector.
The basic idea behind it was the discovery that women use personal pronouns a lot more than men do. Words like you, they, he, she. That's actually one of the most revealing indicators. If you were just to count those, you would probably have at least a half chance of being able to figure out whether it was a man or a woman that had written it.
But don't you have a half chance of figuring whether it's a man or a woman even if you don't count any words at all?
Okay, yeah, granted. But that's why they go on to count other things. For example, you look at how many what are called determiners are used. Those are the things like the, some, more, and men use those more. The basic idea behind it, if you talk to the linguists who've looked at this study, is that it's like that old saw that women write about people and men write about things. And it seems crazy and completely hackneyed, and I sort of resistant to the idea a little bit when I first heard about it. But the numbers do add up. If you even go back a couple hundred years and look at the writings of women clerics, they'd be more likely to write sentences that said, I think, this is true. Whereas a man would just state it. He would just state this is a fact. You know, he had complete confidence in himself. And so it's the inclusion of those things like I think that begin to introduce more personal pronouns into the way that women historically have written.
So hubris, thy name is man.
Yeah, basically. Exactly.
Actually, the first journal that the researchers submitted this research to rejected it on ideological grounds.
That's right. They thought it was potentially kind of sexist because they said you are suggesting that there are innate differences between men and women, and we don't know if that's true. I got to say, I started off being a little skeptical of this, partly because gender science has a long history of starting off with kind of a weird basic premise, which is that men and men are women and never the twain shall meet. And so when you go looking for differences between men and women with that as your starting point, well, you're going to find them. I mean, in the same way that you could do a study saying, well, maybe old people and young people write differently. You could probably find that too, quite frankly. Now, the scientists themselves are very careful. They're walking on eggshells here. They're very careful to say that they're not suggesting any reasons why this happens. They're all, you know, we're just about the numbers. We'll leave it to the philosophers to figure out why men and women do this differently. And that's where the linguists come in and say, well, men and women are trained to talk in different ways.
Now, what's really interesting is that words that you think would actually indicate gender, words that have meaning, words that have an emotional context, or words that pertain to certain subjects, those were eliminated before this evaluation of these pieces began.
Yeah, that's the kind of weird thing about this language analysis stuff. You would think, you know, if you're going to look at something I've written, like an article, that you'd be interested in looking at the major words, like the article I wrote. You think you might pay attention to words like computer or gender or whatever. But when people do these analyses to try and figure out who it was that wrote something, they strip all those big words out. They just leave the little stuff. The theory behind that is that when I'm writing an article, I'm paying attention to the big words. I'm paying attention to the words like computer or artificial intelligence, but I'm not paying attention to how I use words like the and but. Those things are literally unconscious. And because they're unconscious, they leave a fingerprint of who I am.
Well, how much does the intended audience of a piece of writing play into the gender specificity of the text? In other words, if you're writing for a men's magazine or you're writing for a women's magazine, does that muck up the question of these gender signifiers?
Yes, it does, actually. Deborah Tannen, the linguist who writes those books, You Just Don't Understand, Men and Women in Conversation, she studied a lot of how men and women talk differently. And her students once took a look at men's magazines and women's magazines. And it was very easy to spot when someone was trying to write for a men's magazine because they would use these very short sentences. And with women's magazines, they would be longer and they would have more of these pronouns. But the really weird thing was it didn't matter whether a man or a woman had written it, which is to say when women wrote for the men's magazines, they wrote as if they were trying to be a man communicating to men. So obviously there's some part of, you know, being a man or a woman that's about performing it as opposed to being it.
Okay. Clive, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clive Thompson is a writer for Wired, The New York Times, and The Boston Globe. The computer scientists whose research we just discussed are Moshe Koppel, Shlomo Argaman, Anat Rachel Shimoni, and Jonathan Fine. They've written two forthcoming papers, one in the journal Text and one in the journal Literary and Linguistic Computing. In recent times, scientists of various types have tried tracking human social interaction, but people move in mysterious ways. Then came Friendster.com. Friendster is like putting a radio tag on a spotted owl. The social networks of human beings can now be mapped. That, of course, is just a side benefit. Friendster was conceived as a way to make friends. Each user has a personal network, and inviting friends into that network is as simple as finding someone you like, clicking on their profile, and sending them an electronic invitation, provided they're already connected to someone in your network. If they click yes, your networks are pooled, creating an even larger network. Jad Abumrad takes a look.
This is the sound of my friend Amy hitting the enter key on her computer.
Enter, over and over again.
She's been doing it for about 15 minutes. There are thousands of people like her, elsewhere in the world, doing it too, trying to log on to Friendster.com, which is why they're all getting this message.
It says, Friendster is temporarily unavailable. Please check back this evening. We apologize for the inconvenience.
Founder Jonathan Abrams can only shrug.
Well, the growth we've received in the last few months has been crazy, and what people may not realize is that Friendster has been, you know, me and a couple engineer friends out of our living room up until pretty recently.
There are up to 7 employees now. That's roughly 1 staff person for every 130,000 users, almost 1 million in total. And this, says Jonathan, is without any advertising.
You know, it started growing virally from the minute I put up the earliest prototype.
All he had to do, he says, was send the prototype to a friend who sent it to another friend and so on, until word of Friendster eventually infected Amy.
Yay!
Who, after an hour of trying, finally breaks through the gridlock.
I have 17 friends, which is kind of low by some Friendster standards. But my friends and I decided that anybody with more than 50 friends is a Friendster slut.
We're now looking at her personal Friendster page. Amy's picture is there, along with thumbnail photos of her 17 friends.
Carla, Poo-chan, Mary, David.
Clicking on any of their photos takes her to their Friendster page. And from there, she can link to their friends, and from there, to their friends' friends.
I kind of browse.
And with still one more click, 2 friends 4 times removed.
You know, it's like the total safest way of browsing singles in New York.
Safe, she figures, because they're all connected to her, somehow. Friendster, in fact, plots out the connection at the top of each single guy profile she visits.
He's friends with my friend Lily, who's friends with Jason, who's friends with Sarah, who's friends with him.
Wow, so that's 4 degrees, right?
Yep.
And that is where Friendster draws the line, at 4 degrees. Still, when taken out that far, Amy's immediate 17 buddies add up to a social network large enough to fill Madison Square Garden.
82,695 people in my network.
On Friendster, Amy isn't just an anonymous individual. She's a star in her own constellation, in a whole universe of other constellations. She's basically at the center of her own Kevin Bacon game. Friendster and Kevin Bacon owe a debt of gratitude to a 1967 experiment called the Small World Project. Here's what happened. Psychologist Stanley Milgram chose a guy in Boston and then asked 300 strangers to relay him a package.
So, you know, many of them did this, and they sent it on to their friends, and their friends got the same set of instructions and sent it on to their friends and so on.
And eventually, says sociologist Duncan Watts, 60 of Milgram's 300 packages reached the target, getting there in an average of 6 steps.
He never used the phrase 6 degrees of separation, by the way. That was coined by the playwright John Guare.
Nonetheless, that phrase stuck. Duncan even chose it as the title for his recent book. He and his colleagues at Columbia University in New York are repeating the Small World Project, this time on the internet. They're asking thousands to pass on an email to a target, and they're collecting reams of data in the process. With that data, Duncan hopes to test one of Milgram's more controversial claims, that there are certain people in any social network who function like hubs. They've been called mavens, even opinion leaders.
And Milgram called these guys sociometric stars.
Which describes how these nodal folks might look if you mapped the social network they're a part of. They'd be the points with lots and lots of spokes coming out.
But it also can be interpreted as, you know, the guy's a bit of a star.
The sociometric star in Milgram's case was a tailor. Of the 60 packages that made it to his target person, 7 got there through this one guy. Duncan Watts and his team say they haven't yet found evidence of sociometric stars in their repeat experiment. But on Friendster, where adding friends is as easy as clicking a hyperlink, evidence abounds. Take guys like Jordan.
Yeah. Friendster is temporarily unavailable.
Big shocker there.
As usual.
Now, Jordan is one of those people who seems to know everyone, everywhere he goes. And when we finally make it to his Friendster page...
This is my profile picture.
I find out that he has an extended social network the size of a small city.
Jesus, God, you're connected to 239,365?
Right.
How the hell?
See, this is what's been freaking me out about Friendster. I think when you get to a certain point, you know, when you have enough friends, then you're just, like, accessible to enough people that it snowballs, and then anybody can find you, and they do. Because, yeah, I'm getting messages from, like, high school people that I haven't talked to in years.
There's a reason he hasn't talked to them in years. Because he doesn't like them.
I always accept friendships because I feel like it'd be too rude.
This may be one of the trade-offs in a world where everyone can access everyone. See, Jordan is a victim to what sociologists call the familiar stranger phenomenon, which is this. Often in our daily routine, we'll see the same people every day, like on the subway, and we won't say anything to them because they're strangers, and it would be strange to say anything. But if we see these same people in, say, Spain, we're like, hey, how's it going? And Friendster may be just enough of a new environment to bring out all the familiar strangers in Jordan's life, which is bringing him down.
It starts to take up your time if you, like, feel obliged to respond to every message.
Which he says he does. And that's why he's considering committing Friendster suicide, removing his profile altogether. Meanwhile, the site continues to add 20% more users each week, and within 2 months, Jonathan Abrams says they'll begin to charge. And within a few years, some predict Friendster will make yet another leap, off the desktop and into the real world. Sociologist Howard Rheingold thinks so. In his book, Smart Mobs, he imagines what may happen when social networking and mobile technology intersect.
Maybe you can walk down the street and say to your telephone, is there someone who's offering a ride in exactly the direction I'm going right now, and or might be interested in a date on Saturday night? Or who here in this coffee shop likes 6 feet under?
Perhaps as foreshadowing to a time when that will be true. With just one click, my friend Amy shows me all the people in her network who like the TV show 6 Feet Under.
Wow, 6,884 people?
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
It is cool, if you think about it. She may have just cut through years of seedy bar talk to find 7,000 friends of friends who at the very least have the same taste in TV as her. And with another click, she could easily locate fans of her favorite band, The Shins, or The Intuitionist, her favorite book, or all those who like both and live in Brooklyn and vote Democrat and believe in God and a woman's right to choose. Friendster and the Small World Project are slowly leading us toward the answer of how we connect, but we may never know why, only that we do need to. And where there is a will and the website, there is a way. Usually.
Usually you get on after a couple tries. Never is, like, completely, like...
For On the Media, I'm Jad Abumrad.
This is so annoying. Is it really?
Coming up, a look back at the summer of 73, the lasting legacy of a televised scandal called Watergate. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of non-profit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. 31 summers ago, what the Nixon White House called a third-rate burglary occurred at the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate office building. 30 summers ago, the demolition of his administration was being aired live on television for millions to see. Through it all, there was exhaustive coverage of the Watergate scandal. It was a story that made heroes of reporters and a monkey of the commander-in-chief. After the revelations of Watergate, they were openly contemptuous of each other.
Thank you, Mr. President. Dan Rather with CBS News. Are you running for something? notion, Mr. President, are you?
Bob Dole, GOP chairman in the election year of 1972, called the Watergate story a brazen attempt by the Washington Post to bolster the campaign of Nixon challenger George McGovern. Dole said the mudslinging was the work of an old Kennedy coat holder, Ben Bradley, Post editor. But even though the Post was often alone in pursuit of the story, Bradley says the paper is not responsible for what followed.
We didn't bring down Nixon. He brought himself down. You couldn't exaggerate our role. We had a wonderful villain in this matter.
For most people, the story of Watergate did not emerge from the pages of the Post, but from images on the small screen, the televised congressional hearings chaired by Senator Sam Ervin.
We are beginning these hearings today in an atmosphere of utmost gravity. The questions that have been raised in the wake of the June 17 break-in strike at the very undergirding of our democracy.
The language of Watergate became part of our national lexicon.
I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it.
I'm trying to focus on the president. What did the president know, and when did he know it?
Senator Howard Baker asked that last question, and it's resounded in the mouths of reporters about presidents ever since.
Afterwards, our cynicism really prevailed.
Helen Thomas has covered the White House since the Kennedy administration. She says that official lies told by two administrations, first about Vietnam and then about Watergate, made the White House press corps determined not to be burned again.
The White House press room became an arena, really. It was very, very hard to cut through that. There was a lot of ill feeling and passion.
By arena, do you mean like the gladiators were sent into?
Exactly.
Tom Rosensteel, who heads the Project for Excellence in Journalism, says the highly charged atmosphere became the catalyst for a new kind of coverage.
You could call it the personalization of scandal, and it's partly caused by the perception that Watergate was foreseeable if we had probed the inner character of Richard Nixon more carefully before the elections. And it allowed us to expand what was okay for us to look at.
Ben Bradley says that Washington reporters should begin with the assumption that officials are not telling the truth. Rosensteel believes that assumption leads reporters to overlook what the public really wants to know, the substance of a policy, not the political maneuvering behind it.
And we've gotten to the point today where there is a presumption that the politician doesn't believe in this policy he's talking about. He's selling something.
Rosensteel says that President Clinton, perceived as perhaps too nimble when it comes to political principle, sent cynicism soaring, so much so that his was one of the most strained relationships with the press since Nixon.
Your apparent focus on Judge Breyer.
There was strain when a reporter queried President Clinton over his nomination of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Fair of a certain zigzag quality in the decision-making process here. I wonder, sir, if you could kind of walk us through it. Perhaps disabuse us of any notion you might have along those lines. Thank you.
I have long since given up the thought that I could disabuse some of you of turning any substantive decision into anything but political process. How you could ask a question like that after the statement she just made is beyond me.
For 30 years, the president and the press have feuded like an unhappy couple. But under the administration of George W. Bush, rage has turned to resignation. Crushed under the combined weight of 9/11, wartime patriotism, and the president's poll numbers, nobody expects this president to answer tough questions. Case in point, his second primetime press conference held shortly before invading Iraq. The once fire-breathing press corps was seen to be rolling over and playing dead. Washington Post reporter Dana Milbank.
You can imagine that if somebody said, look, Mr. President, this is a charade, you haven't answered the question, that would produce an incredible public backlash.
There were probably 60 reporters in the room. No one did it.
Bob Deans, Cox newspaper reporter and president of the White House Correspondents Association.
This is a president who has put a premium on a certain amount of protocol and respect. This is a guy who, if you holler out a question to him during a pool setting, you will get a glare, and you can be sure he will not call on you. He will not recognize your question. He won't answer it. And so our behavior, to a certain extent, reflects those realities.
The president doesn't like the press. He's not the first to feel that way, and certainly not the last.
Mr. President, you've lambasted the television networks pretty well. Could I ask you, what is it about the television coverage of you in these past weeks and months that has so aroused your anger?
Don't get the impression that you arouse my anger. One can only be angry with those he respects.
As Watergate diminished the president, it elevated the journalist with a considerable boost from Hollywood. The two reporters who broke most of the Watergate story, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, wrote a book called All the President's Men in 1974, but they were immortalized in the movie of the same name, released 2 years later.
You got more than one source.
Yes, Harry.
Who are they?
Sloan
and who else? And there's another guy, Justice, who so far won't confirm the names of the other two who control the fund that we're working on.
Sweat deep throat.
He's not a source on this.
Look, do any of them have an axe?
No.
Personal, political, sexual? Is there anything at all on Mitchell?
No.
Then can we use the names?
No.
God damn it, when is somebody gonna go on the record in this story?
The lesson drawn by a generation of new reporters was question authority, which fit in with the spirit of the time. But because of the movie stars, many of them saw the glamour of the business and missed the grind.
If you look at All the President's Men, the movie, you read the book All the President's Men, you see that there was nothing very exotic about what we did.
Carl Bernstein says the lesson of Watergate for reporters is to work hard. He acknowledges that in many cases that lesson didn't take.
Knocking on a lot of doors, wearing out shoe leather, being respectful of the people you're talking to and interviewing. We used common sense.
Ben Bradley says the lesson of Watergate for politicians is to stop lying. That didn't take either.
America doesn't keep its lessons learned. I mean, I think whatever we learned about Watergate is beginning to disappear.
Meanwhile, respect for politicians and reporters slides over the decades in tandem. Each critic suggests dragging the other down. Journalist Helen Thomas.
We never tried to win a popularity contest. We know we're not loved, even liked. That doesn't matter. The whole attitude toward us has been so cyclical. After President Nixon and Spiro Agnew started the anti-press, anti-media campaign, people would come up and, well, spit on you, literally. They would say, why don't you write the truth, and so forth, and we would really be in the doghouse. After Watergate, people came to me, and not meaning me per se, but the press, and say, you saved the country.
During the dog days of 73, millions of Americans tuned into daily hearings instead of daytime soaps, watching the plot unfold like a Perry Mason trial. The role of Perry Mason was played by Sam Dash, chief counsel to the Senate Watergate Committee. Dash says the made-for-TV drama of the hearings was no accident. He scripted the hearings like a detective story.
Number one, it was my ordering of the witnesses. Having been a trial lawyer, I know that you begin a trial by starting at the very beginning. It's like a detective story. In this particular case, there was the Watergate burglary. There were the cops that arrested the burglars. And then I would bring in a number of accusers, like John Dean, who had been counsel to the president, who was pointing the finger at the president, and Haldeman and Ehrlichman. And so I was setting up this tension of the police work, the work of the people who were involved as co-conspirators, who were accusing, and then ultimately bring the accused, Haldeman, Mitchell, Ehrlichman. And in order to make sure that our story would be told in a consecutive and interesting fashion, every witness that I called had been prior called before an executive committee. In other words, I knew exactly what my questions were going to be, and I knew exactly what the answers were going to be so that I could put it in a form that this would come out like a story. And I think it succeeded in the sense that the American people were glued to their television sets waiting for the next episode.
So you crafted the arc of the story and you rehearsed the witnesses. But what about the members of the Senate Watergate Committee themselves? You told the Daily News that this cast of characters, Sam Ervin and his committee members, were chosen not because of their charisma and mass appeal, but because of their presumed lack of it.
Well, Senator Mansfield, who was majority leader at the time, told Ervin, and Ervin announced it while he was alive, that the members of the committee were chosen primarily because none of them would be a presidential candidate and therefore exploit the hearings for political purposes, and that none of them really were ambitious to do anything more than what they were doing at the time. And so it was an unusual panel of senators who were devoted to trying to get at the truth and at the same time not politicizing it.
What was the most dramatic moment, do you think, when the audience at home in their living rooms was holding its breath?
Well, I think the most dramatic moment of the Senate Watergate Committee hearings, and for the world, not only just the public, is when we produced Mr. Butterfield, who was an assistant to Mr. Haldeman, but he was in charge of the Secret Service.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices, yes, sir.
When were those devices placed in the Oval Office?
Approximately the summer of 1970. I cannot begin to recall the precise date.
That was a Monday, I remember. It was a Monday morning. And when he announced that he had put in this taping system in the Oval Office, it hit like a bombshell, because not only did it mean that we now had corroboration for what John Dean said. John Dean had testified earlier about his meetings in the Oval Office with the president and the planning of the cover-up. But imagine, all over the world, heads of state who had met with the president in secret and had confided in the president to learn now that all of their meetings were taped. It was a major earthquake in the world.
And that earthquake occurred almost exactly 30 years ago this past week.
Yes, and of course that earthquake got the president out of office. And I think what made it work that way was television, because we not only had the networks covering us during the day from 9 to 5, we had public television replaying the hearings at night, the whole hearings, gavel to gavel. I wanted to get over the head of the print media and the radio and TV media, because, you know, they may be good, but they're selective. I had a message through my witnesses to tell the American people how their government had gone wrong and how we almost lost our democracy. And so by having television live, I was able to reach the American citizen in his home, a bedroom, office, and they were there by the millions. They were listening.
What were the ratings during the peak?
I was told that our Nielsen ratings was above all the soaps.
Really?
Yeah. We had the greatest attendance.
You know, Mr. Dash, we've been talking about the main characters in your drama, but we've neglected one, that is to say, you. The Philadelphia Inquirer noted recently that you are remembered for your inherit-the-wind-like cross-examinations. And we have a clip from July 10, 1973, when you faced off against Attorney General John Mitchell. It was about an intelligence plan pitched to Mitchell by G. Gordon Liddy to disrupt the Democrats. Here's Mitchell.
Well, I think it can be best described as a complete horror story that involved a mishmash of code names and lines of authority, electronic surveillance, the ability to intercept aircraft communications, the call girl bit, and all the rest of it.
Well, when Liddy completed his presentation, what was your reaction?
Well, I think it was very simple. As I recall, I told him to go burn the charts and that this was not what we were interested in. What we were interested in was a matter of information gathering and the protection against the demonstrators.
Well, Mr. Mitchell, if this was the kind of plan as you described and has been described this way by other witnesses before this committee, and since you were the Attorney General of the United States, why didn't you throw Mr. Liddy out of your office?
Well, I think, Mr. Dash, in hindsight, I not only should have thrown him out of the office, I should have thrown him out of the window.
You know, Liddy, after that meeting in the Attorney General's office, who was very angry that they turned down his plan as given, came back and told McCord what happened. And the real fact was that it is true that Liddy put on a number of different projects. One was to have call girls out on a yacht outside of Miami during the Democratic convention and to lure the Democratic candidates on the yacht and have them seen with these prostitutes. And he had a budget for everything. What Mitchell really said was, it's too expensive. It costs too much. Come back with a cheaper budget. And that's when Liddy went back and just came back with the break into the Watergate, which Mitchell approved.
As you look back on subsequent hearings that were televised, we had Iran-Contra, and you were involved yourself with Monica Gate, were you not?
That's right. Well, not with the congressional hearings. I was the ethics counsel to Ken Starr.
How do you think that those hearings compare to the Watergate hearings?
The Iran-Contra hearing, the campaign financing hearing, the Whitewater hearings were atrocious. They were the wrong way to put on hearings to get the public to understand the scandal. They didn't begin at the beginning. And none of those subsequent hearings took the time to think through how they were going to inform the public. And it ended up with most of the public being angry at the committee in the Iran-Contra case and sympathizing with Ali North. They didn't have Ali North in executive session to determine what he was going to say. He refused to go, and they allowed him to get away with it. And so the very first time they were hearing answers were in that public hearing, and they couldn't control it. And they looked bad when they were trying to curtail him. I did advise before their hearings that they ought to begin at the beginning in Iran-Contra. Explain to the people who the Iranians were, who the Contras were, what the issue was. They didn't.
Well, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Sam Dash is a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. He served as chief counsel of the Senate Watergate Committee hearings. And I guess if you asked him, he'd probably tell you that all he ever really wanted to do was direct. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Sean Landis, engineered by Dylan Keith and Rob Christensen, and edited by me. We had help from Blake Carlton, Josh Keating, and Jenny Schneier. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the show and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.